think you're gonna get it. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله first of all, I want to apologize for being a little late. I thought I would be here a little earlier to sit and learn while you learn. But alhamdulillah, Allah has allowed me to come and share with you a few ideas about Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin. And primarily, want to try to talk to you and emphasize the conspiratorial nature of the judicial and law enforcement process that put Imam Jamil in prison, being convicted of murder and also being convicted of 13 additional charges and being given the sentence of life in prison without parole. Now, for those of you who may not know about this case, I'm going to just say a few brief things about Imam Jamil, and then we'll go backwards and then come back in time. Now, we'll attempt, inshallah, to try to put the case of Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin in some kind of context for it, so that we can understand why he's in the situation that he's in, Allahu A'lam. But also for us to understand that there is a very serious relationship between what has happened with Imam Jamil and what has happened with us and what will happen with this part of the Ummah, the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and this part of the world. Brothers and sisters, as we first look at the case of the life of Imam Jamil, let me bring you up sort of quickly as to who is this person and why would we bother to even talk about him. There are a number of Muslims in prison throughout the United States. Many of them are charged with murders and double murders. Many of them are charged with robbing banks, trucks, these armored vehicles that transport money from banks and other financial institutions. The Muslims in prison throughout the United States for political crimes. Many of them are there for crimes so-called against the state of America. But I'd like to talk a little bit about and focus specifically on this one imam. Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin. Now, to just say quickly why he's in prison, 2 years ago, after Eid al-Adha, on the night of Eid al-Adha, in March of 2000, members of the Fulton County Sheriff's Department came to serve a warrant on Imam Jamil for failure to appear in court. Now, the reason why he was being summoned to court to begin with was that while he was driving in Cobb County, Georgia, which is in a county adjacent to the county where Atlanta is and where Imam Jamil has his residence, that while he was driving his vehicle, he was stopped by these Cobb County deputies. And when the deputies pulled him over and asked to see his identification, he pulled out his wallet, and inside of the wallet, as he opened it to pull out his driver's license, the deputies who pulled him over noticed that there was what appeared to be a police badge inside of his wallet. And so they asked him, well, what is this? And he explained that this is an honorary police badge from White Hall, Alabama. And so his first charge on that night was the charge of impersonating a police officer, even though he didn't flash the badge, even though it was him as he opened his wallet looking for his driver's license. And then Imam Jamil was charged with driving a stolen vehicle. Even though the vehicle that he was driving at the time was a vehicle that he had purchased off of a legal car lot. If it wasn't a hot car where you just go up on the block and, you know, there's some crackheads or some other people law and they're trying to get rid of their vehicles, he had actually gone and purchased and made arrangements to purchase this vehicle off a legal parking lot, and he had the papers to prove it. But yet, he was charged by the Cobb County Sheriff's Department with impersonating a police officer and driving a stolen vehicle and driving an uninsured vehicle. Now, it comes, and then all is said and done, the only charge that was actually true was that the vehicle had not been properly insured. That the driver's license or the police badge that he had in his wallet was actually given to him by the mayor of Whitehall, Alabama, as an honorary police member of the police force, an honorary member of the police force. And this vehicle, as I said, was properly registered to him. He was paid for the vehicle. Now, on March of 2000, because Imam Jamil did not appear in court in Cobb County on these two charges, the warrants were turned over to the Fulton County Sheriff's Department in Atlanta, and they went to Imam Jamil's place of business, which is a community store in Atlanta, Georgia, and on that night, they attempted to serve a warrant for his arrest to lock him up. Now, the police, the deputies who came to lock him up were two African-American deputies, and one of them, in the course of whatever happened that night, and is still very confusing and almost unbelievable, the account that actually came out in the court and what he was actually convicted of, but what was stated and what is known for a fact, even though Imam Jamil is in prison now, I still don't believe the reason why he was convicted. I don't believe that he actually did what he was convicted of. But what the deputy who actually died, because there was a deputy that died in a gun battle in front of Imam Jamil's store, he was shot and eventually died the next day, and another deputy was shot and was treated for his injuries, and both of these deputies said that they shot the person who shot them. They said that they shot this person in the stomach. They saw him being shot in the stomach. They saw him staggering away. They saw the blood trail dripping from the point where he had been shot off until they couldn't watch him anymore. As a matter of fact, there were people who came forth in the courtroom and said that they actually saw someone staggering up the street from the place where this officer, this deputy was shot and the other one was killed, but they actually saw a man in the street holding his stomach, blood flowing from his stomach, trying to stop vehicles and cars to get away from the scene. And so on that night, the description of Imam Jamil was given by the person who was shot and the two deputies, the one that eventually died and the other one that was shot. The description was, from both of them, that this was a man who had gray eyes. This was a man that was shot in the stomach. This was a man who pulled off in a black Mercedes Benz. And this was a man that when we walked up to him, that he came out with a rifle in one hand and a pistol in the other and just opened fire on us. This is a man, and the same two officers giving a slightly different account. The second surviving officer said that no, actually he was sitting in the car. And while he was sitting in the car, we walked up to the car, Imam Jamil, as they identified, pulled out the gun and pulled out the rifle and started shooting at them. The car in which the deputies were driving, as well as the car that was eventually identified as this vehicle that Imam Jamil was supposed to have been in, were both, especially the deputy's car, were shot full of bullet holes. But a funny thing happened on the way to the trial about a month or so ago now, because the Fulton County Deputy Department said that they had such a shortage on vehicles that they actually
took the doors off the car, repaired the car, destroyed the doors, and put the car back in service. Never mind that this was part of material evidence that would be needed for a trial. We needed the car. So we took the doors off, destroyed the doors, fixed it, and put it back in service. So you just have to take our word for what we've had in these doors. Now, the ballistics evidence that was presented in the case had all kinds of, it contradicted the account of the surviving officer. He was saying he was at one place and he was shooting, but all of the ballistics found something else. There was a man by the name of Otis Jackson, who was a state prisoner in the state of Nevada, who had violated his parole and was in Atlanta, Georgia, he claimed, at the time of the shooting. Otis Jackson claimed that he was the one that actually shot those two officers on that night. He gave a very detailed description of what had happened and said that he was the one that shot those officers. Now, Otis Jackson was picked up by the Nevada State Police and brought back to the state of Nevada and put back in jail when he gave his testimony. But it took over 30 days before authorities in Atlanta realized that there was someone sitting in a state prison in Nevada who had confessed and had given a very accurate description of what had happened on that scene that night. But by the time this became public knowledge and the defense wanted to talk to this man, and not talk to him, but they wanted to get the evidence that he had presented to the police up in Nevada, Otis Jackson recanted his testimony. He said, well, no, I was just playing. I was just trying to be big. No, I didn't have anything to do with it. It wasn't me. Had to be that guy, Rock Brown. All of these very contradictory testimonies came out in the trial of Imam Jamil. As a matter of fact, the testimony was so contradictory that the defense lawyer for Imam Jamil felt assured that they had so totally destroyed the case against them that for the most part they put on very little defense. They thought that we're talking about a capital murder case, someone being tried for their life, and the standard for conviction is guilt beyond reasonable doubt. And so they, the defense team, and those associated with Imam Jamil, along with the talking heads on the television, the news commentators and the news readers on the stations in Atlanta, well, at the editorial writing for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and others in the area said very definitively that this man is going to get off. There is no way, based on the testimony, that this man, who they had no love affair with, they weren't saying it because they loved him and were trying to support him, but they said, based on the testimony that was presented in the case, there's no way that this man could be convicted. But unfortunately, he was convicted. And surprising to many of us, there were 9 African Americans on the jury. The defense felt that in a state like Georgia, if you just got some African Americans on the jury, that some kind of way they would at least have 1 or 2 persons who would say, no, I'm not going to go for a guilty plea, you're going to have to declare a mistrial. But no, all 12 of those jurors came back with the verdict of guilty. Now, my point of departure to go back and then to the past and then come up to the present is this point. Remember, there were 9 African Americans on the jury. The surprising thing by defense attorneys was that the prosecution allowed 9 primarily young African Americans to be on the jury. Now, it may not mean a lot to you here in Canada, but in the States, when you see African-American young men with dreadlocks, when you see African-American young men with wide-rimmed glasses and neatly shaped afros, when you see young African-American men and women coming into the courtroom in African-style clothing, it sort of sends a message to you that this person has some level of consciousness. But what we all became painfully aware of after the jury, after the verdict, was that the prosecution had done their homework much better than those of us in support of Imam Jamil, including his attorneys. Because they realized, and I want to emphasize this to you young folks sitting in here today, that they realized that these young people had no clue. I'm talking about these young African-Americans had no clue who they were sitting in judgment of. They never had an idea who really H.R.O.P. Brown, who Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, who he really was. And so as a result of their being such empty vessels, I'm not saying they're stupid. I'm not saying that they didn't have degrees. I'm not saying that they didn't have, you know, a lot of knowledge and information.
That moves you, my brother. That's kind of wild. I'm looking at a sit still here.
I'm not saying that they didn't have a lot of knowledge and information. But the prosecution understood that these young people did not have a sense of history. That they didn't have a clue who this man was. Now let me go back a little bit, and then we'll come back, and I'll try to make it relevant to you and I today. Imam Jamil was born as Hubert Brown. He was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He was born, I think, probably 58 years ago in one of the most racist states in the country of the United States. That this man, Hubert Brown, went to a university in New Orleans called Southern University. That part of the time he was an athlete. He was a very athletic young man. That he wasn't showing any signs like his big brother Ed at that moment, that he was really concerned about the affairs of oppressed people and his being a part of a very oppressed community of people, being an African-American in Louisiana back during the 1950s. So he was an athlete. He did what so many of us did. He played athletics. He worked his body. He worked his mind, but not reading a whole lot. And then when he went to Southern University, he got to his senior year, and then he decided that he would visit his big brother in Washington, D.C., Ed. And Ed was very politically involved.
And that from that move.
Ed was very politically involved in Washington, D.C. Ed was so involved in Washington.
Yeah, it might help. It might put my head over the mic.
Ed was so involved that his little brother, Hubert, at that time, I don't think that in Alamo's death that he was actually being called Rock at this time. But Ed was so involved that he influenced his younger brothers, and Hubert was influenced by his big brother to actually stay in Washington, D.C., to drop out of school, out of college during his senior year to get involved in the struggle for equality. And so this is what he did. He dropped out of school during his senior year and got very involved in the work around voting issues and other issues from Washington, D.C., and then going back into the South. And we found that it was during this particular period, while he was in Washington, D.C., that people began to refer to Hubert not just as Ed's little brother, but began to refer to him as Rap. And this moniker, that this name stuck with him all the way up until the time that he embraced Islam. And so here we have now H.R.O.P. Brown in the 1960s in Washington, D.C. We find H. Rock Brown going down into Mississippi in 1964, helping and working with the people to try to get increased voter registration among African American people. Now, if you don't understand, if you're like some of those young people who were on that journey, let me just digress for a moment and tell you that in 1964, 1963, when he was down in Mississippi and Alabama doing voter registration, that this part of the United States and almost all of the United States was just like apartheid South Africa. That there were signs up everywhere. I grew up in this environment in North Carolina, that there were signs up saying colored, signs saying white. And when you went to a restroom in a public facility, you went to the colored restroom hole in the wall called a bathroom with the colored sign. And the nice, clean bathrooms were reserved for white folks. But when you went to a water fountain somewhere, you had to go in that water fountain that was almost down on the ground, and then when you turned it, you didn't know what kind of brown fluid was going to come up out of there at any time, as opposed to the fountain that was reserved for white folks. And I'm not a real old man. I'm not even as old as Imam Jamil. But that's the state and the condition of society that I grew up in, and it was even worse for him down in Louisiana. So Imam Jamil, H. Rock Brown, at this point, develops a consciousness. And he goes back into Mississippi, and he goes into Alabama, and he's doing these voter registration drives, and he's working with the people in these areas. And people began to, as I say, call him Rap, and one of the reasons they were calling him Rap was because he had an uncanny kind of ability to communicate with the uneducated brothers and sisters on the street. The just the boys hanging out on the block, Rap Brown had the ability, even though he was college educated, and by this time had read very many books and had a very extensive vocabulary, but he could talk and relate to the most common uneducated brother or sister on the street. And so this label, Rap Brown, began to stick on him. And so rather than anybody referring to him from this point as just Ed's little brother, now he began to take on an identity of his own as H. Rap Brown. And so we find that there was an organization that was existing that his big brother joined, and like his big brother, H. Rap Brown joined too, and the organization was called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, referred to at that time as SNCC and referred in the history of the organization called SNCC. Now, SNCC was a non-violent student group arranged of a group that was associated, that spawned from the group of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And SNCC was an organization that started out just like so many of the people in the non-violent civil rights movement, like Dr. Martin Luther King. They started off saying that young people have to get involved in the struggle and we have to be nonviolent. This is the way that this organization started out. There are many graduates of the SNCC organization, a graduate like who's in the Congress right now, a man by the name of John Lewis. There are people in so many different prominent in the U.S. Congress, in so many different prominent positions, who were part of this organization called SNCC, the former mayor of Washington, D.C., Marion Barrett. They're scattered all over the place. So SNCC had this leader, one of the chairmen at the time, and I'll jump forward a couple of years, they had a chairman by the name of Stokely Carmichael. Stokely Carmichael was a very articulate young man, I think he was from Trinidad originally. He'd gone to Howard University, and Stokely was the chairman of SNCC. And a lot of things were happening in America at that time, so around 1966, Stokely and others were riding in a car, and Stokely happened to holler out the window as he passed by a group of African Americans, Black Power, and did a script like this. And it just so happened that there were some journalists around when he stuck his fist and hollered out, Black Power! But I'm fascinated with it. Stokely told me himself that he didn't think anything about it. He just happened to change from within. This was no hot, long, thought out ideology or anything. He just stopped kidding. He just hollered out, "Black power!" But the media jumped on this. And they jumped on this and they thought that this was something that was fascinating. So they began to question him as the chair of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee as, "What do you mean by that?" And so from that just almost inadvertent, just shouting out something, this whole concept began to be put and shaped into an African-American context and talking about black power, and then a dialogue, a critical dialogue and discussion developed within the civil rights movement and particularly the youth movement talking about black power. Now, Stokely Carmichael, whose son is a Muslim, I mean a very sincere, practicing Muslim, Stokely died a few years ago. He had embraced the name Kwame Ture. He and Imam Jamil remained lifelong friends, even up to the point of his death a few years ago. But Stokely was a very fiery speaker. He scared a lot of people with his rhetoric. And so at a certain point, Stokely Carmichael now was saying that the people within SNCC were saying, "Stokely, you know, get all of us in trouble here in SNCC. I think we need to turn to somebody who's a little less radical, who's not going to incite people the way that you're doing." So they turned to an almost relatively unknown, almost quiet person within the organization called Rap Brown. And the people in SNCC actually thought by making H. Rap Brown the chairman of the organization that the organization could take a lower profile and they could go about the quiet work of organizing people throughout the South. But surprise, surprise, surprise. Because H. Rap Brown took rhetoric and fiery rhetoric to another level. And as the chairman of SNCC, not only did he not start backing down, he was raising the profile, the rhetoric index, and the militant rhetoric index of young people, and particularly those who were in this organization called SNCC. And so he had a number of different kinds of experiences that here's what a kind of fearless presentation as he walked around the racist South, as he organized folks for voter registration drives, as he organized farming cooperatives and other outlets for the African-American farmers, that he was showing an uncanny kind of courage that many people in that area had said that they had never seen a black man as fearless as this man called H. Rap Brown. I am telling you this because I've been in many of those areas. I was there more than a decade after H. Rap Brown was in those areas, and I had the opportunity to interact and meet with some of those people that he had influenced, including a man named Gilmore, who was a sheriff in Utah, Alabama, which considered the black, one of the five counties that are considered the black belt in Alabama, where SNCC was very active. These were the counties that became the black belt because they had a high concentration of African slaves during the period of slavery in the United States. And a lot of these folks, the descendants of these folks, never moved out. So in Alabama today, there are five counties that are considered the black belt that SNCC concentrated on during voter registration and these kinds of things. And so I want to get to a point. And the point that I want to get to in talking about Imam Jamil and the conspiracy that convicted him just a few weeks ago and put him in prison for life without parole started in the year, and a lot of this, it started in 1967. 1967 was a tremendously important and a red letter year for Imam Jamil. It is a year that I submit on this date started a conspiracy by the United States government to do, to either kill or to put this man in prison like he has been sent away. Let me tell you a few events about 1967, and then maybe somebody will share in this assessment. In 1967, as chair of SNCC, Imam Demir, at that time still Etrat Brown, was traveling around the South organizing as the leader of the organization, but he was also coming outside of the deep South and going into Washington, D.C., and going into various parts of Maryland and Virginia. On one of these trips into a city called Cambridge, Maryland, the Imam Demir went to Cambridge, Etrat Brown went to Cambridge, Maryland, at the invitation of many of former SNCC members who had been organizing with him in the Deep South, and at the invitation of young students like the brothers and sisters who are here today. And those former members of SNCC and those young students were tired of the Ku Klux Klan raiding into certain areas in the African-American community. They were tired of chronic terrorists picking people off as they walked down the street by themselves and beating them up and trying to run over them with their cars or throwing bottles at them or shooting at them as they just walked down the street. So they were tired of it. And so they said, well, maybe we can't do anything by ourselves, but we know that there are some people who want to do something about this. So they got in contact with SNCC and requested that Etrat Brown personally come to Cambridge, Maryland, to try to talk back down some of the racist terror that they were experiencing. And so Etrat Brown went to Cambridge, Maryland in 1967. And the story goes that he went there and he stood on the hood of a car. And he gave a speech that just lit the people up. The real rap was coming out. And at that moment, Etrat Brown was telling those people assembled and everybody who heard his voice that if America wants to play Nazi, black folks sure enough ain't going to play Jews. That if Americans and the American government want to play Nazi, black folks ain't going to play the Jews. And a lot of that, but what he's saying and what we understand that he was saying was that no, we're not just going to go quietly off into some kind of smoke. That if you come, then we know your intention when you come, so we're going to meet you with something. We're not going to just lead me off like a sheep and then go ahead and do your slaughter. Now you come, bring something with you when you come, because we're going to be ready for it. And he stood on the hood of his car in 1967 in Cambridge, Maryland, and he told the people of the community that if here it is in 1967, here it is that they passed federal laws breaking down certain laws of apartheid. Here it is, you no longer have to go to the back door of a restaurant and have your food handed to you and told that you can't eat here, but the people that came that haven't gotten the message yet. So Etrat Brown says, standing on that car, that if they are not, and this business community is not going to treat you in the manner you're supposed to be treated like a human being, then maybe you need to burn the business community down. But if they're going to give us a self-standard elementary school, because he said, I've been past that school, and I see the hole, the pit that you're sending your little children in elementary school, and I look at the elementary schools that the white folks are going to, so if they're going to continue to force you to go to this school in 1957, maybe y'all need to just burn it down. Unfortunately, that night, about an hour after he had made these remarks, much of the downtown district in Cambridge, Maryland, went up in flames. The elementary school that he was saying that it's a shame that they're sending your kids to this school got burnt down to the ground. This is in the summer of 1967. The governor of the state of Maryland, so Iman H. Brown that night was shot by a police officer as he was trying to walk an elderly African-American home, a woman home, so she could be safe. And he was cited, not involved in any kind of burning or anything like that, but he was seen by a police officer and shot. So he, at that moment, in 1957, said, well, wait a minute, these guys trying to kill me, so maybe I need to get up out of here. I need to leave. So in 1957, he attempted to leave the state of Maryland, thinking that things, maybe this is just some independent act by some racist police officer, so I'll go the next morning and try to get on a plane to rent to the airport, and he was arrested at the airport. But what happened in between was that the governor of the state of Maryland, the governor, a criminal by the name of Spiro T. Agnew, a criminal who became the vice president of the United States under another criminal by the name of Richard Milhouse Nixon, but this criminal who was the governor of the state of Maryland had to resign in disgrace during the first term of Richard Milhouse Nixon because his past is catching up with him. He loved taking money under the table. He loved the contractors coming, greasing his pockets. He loved people buying his insurance, so it finally caught up with the criminal, so he ends up leaving the vice president office in disgrace. But in 1967, as the governor of the state of Maryland, Spiro T. Agnew, who was known for his critical comments about young people like yourself, but Spiro T. Agnew said that he used to refer to people like you who are in college, if you protested against the policies of the federal government, he would refer to you as an effete, effeminate, intellectual snob. Right? This is how the vice president of the United States talked about young people who were in college, male and female. Well, he wasn't calling the female effete, but he referred to the men. That if you demonstrated or talked out against the policies of the government, he called you a sissy. He called you a weak punk. You're protesting against the war because you're a sissy. You're a punk. And that's why you're doing it. America doesn't need any little sissies like you. Why don't you go to Vietnam and join the Viet Cong if you think we shouldn't be killing all those people over there? But back to my story. In 1967, after Cambridge, Maryland had a significant part of its area burnt, Spiro T. Agnew said that, I hope that we catch this man, H. Rap Brown, real soon. I hope that once we catch him, we lock him up as fast as we possibly can. And I hope and I pray that once we lock him up, we throw away the key and forget about him and never let this man get back on the street again. This is the governor of the state of Maryland, without any benefit of a trial, without anything, saying that he wants this man found, lock him up, throw away the key, and forget about it, in 1967. In 1967, the U.S. government came out with a program called COINTELPRO. It was a dirty trick program. It was a program that targeted African-American activists. It was a program that the guy who was the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, a man with very perverse tastes, a man who was preoccupied with the bedroom habits of other men. And so therefore he would turn his agents loose and people like Martin Luther King, like everybody who was standing up protesting against any government policy that this man used this agency called the FBI to spy on and peer in and peek through the windows and take pictures and all of these things of anyone that was from particularly the African American or the Native American community and was offering up any kind of protest against what the official policies of the U.S. government were all about. So in 1967, the federal government of the United States unleashed a program called COINTELPRO. And without that, it was a dirty trick program. It would be hard to really fully, in these few minutes, for you to understand how dirty it really was. Because this was a program that was organized by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and it was a program not just to try to monitor and find out what people were doing, but it was a program that was designed to cause different factions in the activist community to have conflict with one another and even to kill one another. It was a program that was designed, in the words of J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI at that time, may Allah give him everything that he deserves as a reward, that J. Edgar Hoover said in his own words that this program is designed to stop the rise of a black messiah in America that would come and unite these people and serve as an interference, as an impediment to the carrying out of United States domestic policy. And there was no mystery what this was all about, because the head of the FBI said that this is a program that we'll do whatever needs to be done to stop the rise of a so-called black messiah. And so they looked around and they say, well, who are the potential candidates? What are the groups that we need to monitor? Now, you would think that the first people they would be looking at would be people like Stokely Carmichael, who later changed his name to Kwame Ture, looking at H.R.A.P. Brown, who we know as Imam Jamil Al-Alami. But no, they started with people like the Apostle of Peace, as the Christians like to refer to Martin Luther King. That he was the primary person on the target, someone running around the nation saying, don't fight back, be nonviolent. But H.R.A.P. Brown was also on this list. And so H.R.A.P. Brown was looked at in 1967 and in subsequent years as a potential candidate to try to galvanize the struggle in the African-American community and being what Hoover said, this black messiah that's going to pull everybody together. And so the governor of the state of Maryland is saying, find him, lock him up, throw away the key. Director of the FBI, as he unleashed his COINTELPRO, put H.R.A.P. Brown on the list and say that we have to undermine and do whatever we can do against these people. Let me give some quick examples, young folks, because it's important that you understand, even though you're living here in Canada right now, it's important to understand the possibilities that exist in Canada because of the influence and the pressure of your neighbor to the south, the U.S. Give you some possibilities. Possibilities happened in 1967 and all the way into the 70s when the FBI would take copies of the Black Panther Party paper and produce a phony Black Panther Party paper. They would print up thousands of papers and distribute it in the area before the Panthers could put their real paper out, and would target distribute these papers to cause problems and conflict between different individuals and groups. They would send letters to people and have the exact precise handwriting, signature, send a letter to, from, say, Huey Newton, the head of the Panthers, to this Ron Karim, the head of the organization called UP out in California, that eventually they end up blasting on each other and killing members of each other's group, but more particularly the Panthers and killing our members of UP, because in part through the FBI fabricating letters and sending these letters to the various heads and organizations, talking about your mama, talking about your ugly wife, and your pop, you will kill you, and if we see you on the street again, we're going to come by and kill you. But it was all made up. It took 20 years to go by before many in the struggle realized that a lot of that animosity and hatred that was being built up and that existed was something that was manufactured by Made in USA. And so you have to understand, y'all, especially for us, all of us who are Muslim. And I'm not trying to get anybody to start looking at their brother all sideways and, oh, I'm going to look up with every hour, man, you know, this guy's criticizing me all the time. I'm not trying to get you to do that, but I think you need to understand that this deen of Islam has safeguards that those of us who were involved in this struggle back in the 60s and 70s that we didn't have. And the safeguard for us is to keep your tongue and your hand off your brother or your sister. But the something that we owe to each other is brothers and sisters. So when somebody comes pouring the poison in your ear, or you get a letter reading that somebody says something about you, mashallah. Because I'm not going to return in time the bad, ill words that I had coming at me. It may be real, and it may not. Let me go a little further with the history of 1967. 1967 was also a year in which the across the country in the United States, a lot of domestic violence just exploded in the form of spontaneous riots across the country. And as these spontaneous combustions, like in Dayton, Ohio, would come about, these social combustions in cities across the country, many of the causal agents, and many of the people said that that man, H.R.F. Brown, is behind this. So in 1967, in Dayton, Ohio, H.R.F. Brown was accused of being a part of criminal syndication, like he's a big mafia don or something like that. So all around the land, various charges were being filed against him. So Imam DeMille said, now wait a minute, man, they stacking the deck on me now. It might be time for me to leave and rather than go to court for the rest of my life. So he disappeared. Before going to court on this charge of inciting a riot in Cambridge, Maryland, Imam DeMille, the day before court, disappeared. Part of the reason why he disappeared and Alame's death, because two of his good friends and workers and Smith who were coming to visit him where he was, where the trial was to begin in Bel Air, Maryland, where the trial had moved from Cambridge to Bel Air, that as they came to visit him, the car that they were riding in exploded and killed both of them, blew them all up so bad that they were beyond recognition. The rumor at the time was that Imam DeMille was in that car, that he was in the car. So a lot of us, oh man, got blown away with Featherstone and some other bus guy, I think his name was Payne, got blown away in the car. So there was this attempt, and Alamo's death, that a seeming attempt to kill him before this trial got underway. So he disappeared. Right? He disappeared. And one of the places that he was at during his time of disappearance was up here in Canada. Canada has been very nice to folks fleeing from the time of slavery up until today. It's been very, except for whenever I start to go to Montreal and they stop me in customs and do all what they do for 2 or 3 hours, it's a different story of what it had to be. But Canada in general has been very gracious in opening its borders from people fleeing oppression from the United States. So H.R.F. Brown came into Canada and was hiding out in Canada. He surfaced in New York City, and he surfaced and some kind of setup, and I have to speak a little quickly here to get to the point of running out of time, but when he resurfaced, he resurfaced and got involved in a gun battle had been outside of this bar with the police because one of the people who was with him had informed the police that he was going to be in this area at this time. So when he showed up, they were already there. And a gun battle ensued, and he was injured and shot up pretty bad. He was placed in an ambulance and taken so far away. It was like this is one of them gray line tours or something. You just see New York City. Rather than the hospital, you know, let's fly through Harlem. Let's go up, look at Ellis Island, the Statue of Liberty. Let's ride over here. Let's look at the bridge over Jersey City. Let's give him a tour. Let's show him. But by the grace of Allah, he did not die. In 1971, while in Greenhaven State Prison, he embraced the religion of Islam. In 1976, he was released from Greenhaven Prison and as a Muslim and moved to Atlanta, Georgia, where he became active with the Muslims in the western area. They developed a mosque, and then he eventually became the imam of this West End community mosque. As the imam of this mosque in the West End of Atlanta, Georgia, he was confronted with some decisions. Do I have an introverted kind of mosque going on where we're just solely concerned about the salat and keeping the ranks straight inside the mosque, but every time the children and the women and the adults step outside the door, that the drugs and the other things, the prostitution, is overrunning us, or do we do something to try to, if we're going to stay in this area, to clean up the area? Imam Jamil and those who were in that community chose the latter. And the community in West End Atlanta was a transformed community as a result of the Muslims in that area. Now, I've given you the event that led up to the arrest and the conviction of Imam Jamil. And in the 2 or 3 minutes that I have left, I just want to just emphasize to us why it is important for us to understand what has brought us to this, or that's 5 minutes, okay, that what has brought us to this point in the history of Islam in the United States and its relationship to young folks, particularly as the brothers and sisters who are here today. Brothers and sisters, if a person, the stature of Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, who at the time of his arrest had been the emir, or the convener of the National Shura Council, that's made up of Ithna, the organization of Imam Waqi Muhammad, and the organization that he was the head of was 34 different jama'at that had an affiliation that were part of his leadership across the United States and the Caribbean. But if in fact we can see a high profile imam like Imam Jamil, who politicians like the former mayor and Andrew Young, the former mayor, Maynard Jackson, and Andrew Young was also the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, who actually came as a character witness for Imam Jamil at his trial. That the long list of so-called dignitaries and all of these folks, that if in fact someone of the social and religious stature of Imam Jamil can be snatched up off of the street, charged and convicted of the crime, that those like myself who know him and those who know him even better say that at this stage of his life it would be impossible and a lot of best for him to do what he was convicted of doing. That if in fact someone of his stature, someone of his reputation, someone of his national and international recognition can be snatched up and barely a murmur, relative barely a peep, comes from the rest of the ummah in this part of the world, then surely those who have created these conditions, those who I believe have continued a conspiracy against him since 1967. Then the prospect for you and I to live an unmolested Muslim life without having at some point in the near future to face similar, if not the same, similar relative to our own stature and position and our Islamic work, then we are, I think we're sadly deluding ourselves that this ummah of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in this part of the world has a, is up against some tremendous challenges that afford us tremendous opportunities. And I say to you, and I say to you in all sincerity, that Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin is okay. He's alright. He's in good shape. As a matter of fact, the times that I attended before the conviction, I felt like a spiritual and moral weakling every time I saw him, because of the strength that he just exudes, the Islamic strength that he exudes. Right now he's on 23-hour-a-day lockdown. But these folks who are his incarcerated at this point, that the agencies of the state of Georgia and the government of the United States are so preoccupied with this man as a symbol of who he actually is as a Muslim, and yet he represents to other people that he's in 23-hour lockdown in complete isolation from all of the other inmates and mostly of any other human contact, that he gets out 1 hour a day. They put him out in the courtyard for so-called recreation 1 hour a day by himself in a cage, in a metal cage, in shackles inside of a metal cage, 1 hour a day in the middle of an empty courtyard. So the conspiracy against the symbol of what Imam Jamil represents, a person who's calling people to La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, not calling people to pick up guns and run around shooting people. He wasn't standing on call in West End, Atlanta, Georgia, telling them to go downtown and burn up Peachtree Plaza. He wasn't telling anyone to do that. He was inviting people, telling people that come and get in the salat line, that if you want to be strong, it starts in the salat line. So this is the message of Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, and this is the message that before they were afraid that he would incite with his rapping militancy among African-American people, now there's a greater fear and a greater conspiracy to silence this man because of the symbol and who he actually is and what he represents as a Muslim and as a Muslim leader. So he made his decision. And in closing, I want to ask myself and ask you. Yeah, very good. The response of the Muslims when Imam Jamil was first arrested, and the response of the Muslims leading up to his trial, the response of the Muslims after the trial has been one that, quite frankly, starting with myself, I'm ashamed of the little that I have done since this trial started, since this whole episode started. I'm ashamed of myself first. I'm not trying to condemn nobody, for I start condemning myself. I know, and Allah knows best, that I could and I should have done more than what I've done. I feel bad about that. And I'm trying to make amends for that, to try to do more at this point. But my response, my weak response, was typical of the response of not just the Muslims outside of his, outside of his organization, but even the Muslims within the organization. Imam Jamil made a decision a long time ago. He recognized that Allah has divided society up into some broad categories. You're a believer, you're an unbeliever, or you're a hypocrite. And he made a decision, a letter out on what camp he wanted to be in. And he's prepared, and he is dealing with that decision. That was a choice, a conscious choice that Allah allowed him to make, and he's satisfied with it. He's satisfied with the decision that he has made. And so now, you and I are going to have to make a decision. Because we're not going to be left alone, brothers and sisters. You and I are going to have to make a decision about what camp, where are we going to be. What are you going to choose to do with your life? Nobody's talking about sounding the jihad alarm. We're not talking about that. But on a day-to-day basis, every day, from the time you leave this masjid to the time you close your eyes, you should consciously pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that when the pressure comes on you, that you'll be able to stand strong. But you won't be one that wilts like a flower out in the sun. Imam Jamil stands strong. And his strength is an inspiration to me. It's an inspiration to everybody how he is standing under these circumstances. I don't know how I would respond to anything similar to that. I might slip out if I'm arrested for 48 hours, 24 hours, 12 hours. Because I haven't experienced that before. I don't know what I would do. But I pray every day that if and when the time comes, no matter what level of sacrifice that Allah calls upon me to make every day of my life, that Allah give me the strength to stand strong to the same cause to Islam. To recognize that whatever happens to me and happens to us, it's happening because this is what Allah and His messengers have promised. And to make me and to make us plead with Allah as our Lord, that's all that we need. And have Allah plead with us as His servants. So brothers and sisters, I close at this point. I appreciate the moments that you've allowed me to share some ideas with you about Imam Jamil. The direct answer was that conspiracy against Imam Jamil was almost best within my heart. I believe that there's been a 35-year conspiracy to either kill or put this brother in the position that he's in now as we sit here saying that there's life in prison, natural life in prison without parole. And so I pray that we remember Imam Jamil and all of our leadership in our dua. I pray that Allah will strengthen our Muslim leaders and strengthen us as followers, so that we will make the choices and decisions that Allah will be pleased with us in our choices, because we're pleased with Allah as our Lord. That's my lesson.